News. I'm Jim Bertel. Churches in Sri Lanka were mostly empty Sunday as Christians stayed home, 1 week after a series of deadly bombings by Islamist militants. The Archbishop of Colombo, Cardinal Malcolm Ranjith, held a televised mass attended by the president and the prime minister.
We are truly sorry for all the families that have lost their loved ones and their dear ones. And I ask you, dear brothers and sisters, please pray for them.
The country's former Chief Justice, Sarath Silva, joined more than 100 Buddhist monks to remember the victims of the Easter Sunday bombing.
But unfortunately, what has happened is happened. And it is our duty to express our solidarity with the totality of the Sri Lankan population.
Outside of San Diego, California, authorities say a 19-year-old man opened fire on a synagogue on the last day of Passover, killing one woman and wounding three others. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem that two of the injured are from Israel.
During the service for the last day of the Passover holiday, 19-year-old John Ernest burst into the Chabad synagogue and opened fire with an assault rifle. Witnesses said 60-year-old Lori Gilbert Kay jumped in front of Rabbi Yisrael Goldstein and was killed. The rabbi was wounded, losing two fingers. Two other worshippers, both Israelis, were also wounded. 8-year-old Noya Dahan was wounded by shrapnel, and her uncle, Almog Peretz, was shot in the leg. The Dahan family had moved to the San Diego area from the Israeli town of Sderot, near the border with the Gaza Strip, to escape frequent Palestinian missile attacks. Linda Gradstein for VOA News in Jerusalem.
And from Washington, this is VOA News. A divided Spain is voting Sunday in its third general election in 4 years. All eyes are on whether a far-right party will enter parliament for the first time in decades. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
Polling shows no party's close to gaining a majority, so a deadlocked parliament is a strong possibility. The campaign has focused on Spaniards' hearts rather than their wallets, for the first time since the financial crisis. As political commentators have been pointing out, though, one result is certain from the choice of leading candidates. Spain's next prime minister will be young, cosmopolitan, white and male.
That was Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. Airstrikes hit the Libyan capital late overnight as Eastern forces loyal to Khalifa Haftar continued their campaign to take Tripoli. Haftar's Libyan National Army has repeatedly flown airstrikes since starting an offensive 3 weeks ago to take the capital held by the internationally recognized government. The Tripoli forces have pushed back the LNA on the ground in some southern suburbs in recent days. Mozambican authorities are urging people to seek higher ground to avoid the flooding and mudslides that are expected in the aftermath of Cyclone Kenneth. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The flooding is worsening, with waters now waist-high in places. The government has urged people to immediately seek higher ground. Hundreds of thousands of Mozambicans are at risk. Residents in the region's main city, Pemba, are reported to be frantic as rushing waters flood their homes and heavy rains fall. Women and girls have used buckets and pots to try to scoop the torrent from their front yards, but in vain as the water has continued to pour in. Authorities say there have been a number of deaths after Cyclone Kenneth arrived Thursday evening with the force of a Category 4 hurricane. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The death toll from Kenneth stands at 5. The film Avengers Endgame is on track to become the biggest film of the year. Over the weekend, it was smashing records around the world. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
Thanos did exactly what he said he was going to do. He wiped out 50% of all living creatures.
And Avengers Endgame is doing exactly what the Walt Disney Company hoped, wiping out the competition, setting multiple box office records just a day after its release. Its Thursday previews and Friday opening brought in a record $156.7 million in North America, easily topping Star Wars The Force Awakens and Avengers Infinity War.
This is the fight of our lives.
It also set a record globally with $644 million by the end of Friday. I'm Ben Thomas.
And I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
We look forward to this, to be implemented immediately. The processes that they have to follow to be able to implement the bill through the Office of the Attorney General, the National Justice Commission, these are issues we think, should not delay the process.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari signs the minimum wage bill into law.
We need like a genuine deal from military to cooperate with the civilians to manage to take the government away from all the bad practices and corruptions and all failures that Sudan come across in the last 30 years.
Sudanese opposition groups and the military council agreed to form a joint transitional authority.
Why in the letter the president is telling Dr. Riek Machar that he should not focus on ticking all the boxes? Why should we not tick all the boxes? This is something that we agreed to, that it is possible, and all the boxes that were supposed to be ticked during the pre-transitional period must be ticked.
And the former South Sudanese Affairs Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar, to lead a delegation to an IGAD meeting in Ethiopia this week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has signed into law a 30,000 naira minimum wage, which paves the way for state governments, ministries, departments and agencies for implementing the new pay structure. Labor unions have hailed the move as a step in the right direction. However, some Nigerians worry that there could be delays in the implementation of the law. They are calling on labor unions to put pressure on the administration to prevent bureaucracy from hampering the implementation of the new minimum wage law. For reaction, I reach Chris Iyot, the Deputy General Secretary of the Nigerian Labour Congress.
Well, we commend the President for signing the bill into law. And even though it is belated, but at least given the controversy and activities that went into signing the bill, we commend him for doing that. And we are looking forward to the implementation of the law that's immediately.
How soon do you expect it? Because some people are suggesting the implementation should date back to the 1st of April. What is Labour anticipating?
Of course. The day that the president signed the bill into law is when the law will commence.
So after all these months of pressure on the government, what would Labour say, or what are some of your members saying about the final step? And do you expect any hitches before the implementation?
Well, we don't expect hitches. It's a law. A law has to be obeyed. But of course, there will be some mysterious persons within government who might want to delay an implementation of the law, particularly some of the governors. And so we are also ready to take them on.
Some are expressing concern that perhaps the Attorney General and Minister of Justice should do a few things before to ensure there are no delays. Others are also speculating that the governors might try some tactics to delay the implementation thereof. As Labour, what are your major concerns since this is law?
Well, the process is very clear. The Attorney General will have to do the needful, as it were, and the National Wages and Salaries Commission is supposed to come up with the template. And so we don't really, we don't have a message that's too much delay from the part of the federal government. Questions or issues that are supposed to set the ball rolling. We don't expect to come up from the federal government.
Now, Chris, there have been reports that the National Salaries, Incomes and Wages Commission sometimes delay on the payment of new minimum wage on the non-release of the copy of the act to enable it to prepare the memo for state government to commence payment immediately. What is your take?
Well, that is the process. It is the Wages Commission that will do that. We are looking forward to them to do it as immediately. In fact, immediately after the meeting, if such processes have not been fulfilled, we have to take it up very seriously.
Will Labour approach them in order to ensure that they keep to the process and that there are no bureaucracies to delay this? Because your members, I understand, for all these months have been calling for this implementation. There were delays and all that. So they are saying that this should be done and done immediately. What are your thoughts?
Well, for us, really, we, like I said, we look forward to this, to the wage implemented immediately. The processes that they have to follow to be able to implement the bill through the Office of Attorney General, the National Wages Commission, these are issues which we think should not delay the process. Of course, we are also members of the National Salaries and Wages Commission. We are very confident that the Wages Commission will fast track the process of coming out with the template.
So what is the message here to your people now that the president has signed this bill into law officially?
Well, our message to workers generally is that the struggle has not finished yet. We should continue to mobilize, be vigilant, and ensure that those state governments that are going to be a problem, will have to be dealt with adequately.
Chris Uyot is the Deputy General Secretary of the Nigerian Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Citizens of Benin vote in an election Sunday to elect new parliamentarians, but the government has barred all opposition political parties from participating. Meanwhile, local media reports say internet connectivity has been restricted, preventing citizens from using social media platforms, including WhatsApp, Facebook, and Twitter. For the latest development, VOA's French to Africa reporter Raisa Girondin reached Omar Aruna, the former Benin ambassador to the United States.
The major change that have prevented the opposition to participate is a purely administrative change that the government put in place to undermine the opposition party. Basically, they say that they have to have a certificate of compliance. A certificate of compliance was never in the electoral code. And the person who's supposed to administer that certificate of compliance is the Minister of Interior, who also is a candidate on a presidential list. So you see that, and the constitution is clear about the conflict of interest. So this is one of the major technicalities that was put by the constitutional court to prevent the opposition party to participate.
The president said that this new electoral code was to put an end to a bunch of political parties. In Benin, there were more than 250 parties. He wanted to reduce this number. So what do you think about this?
I think this is something that needs to happen over time. You don't just reduce numbers, just like you're reducing the will of people. Yes, Benin in 1990 have basically adopted what they call the integral and the full democracy. And anyone that is in place of participating in elections should participate. The number of parties should be reduced naturally as people form a group and aggregate to go to election. That's how you reduce the number of parties. But you just don't impose, say that you create a two-party that you funded, and then you say these are the two parties that I want to be participating in election.
Does the population feel represented by those two parties?
People don't recognize themselves in those parties because people have opposing view, and that's actually the essence of a strong democracy, having an inclusive election with opposing view. That's what we don't have in this election coming up in Benin. And this is dangerous because we're going to go to an election under the gun while the military are on the street with their apparatus chasing you around.
The European Union decided to suspend its mission to observe the election. How should it be interpreted?
I think it is a good thing. However, I wanted the European Union and all the international partners of Benin to go further. They should just say to Patrice Talon, we're not going to recognize your the legislative if it happened under this condition of exclusion.
So if those legislative elections are taking place, what could be the consequences of having no opposition at the parliament?
We are looking toward a post-electoral crisis. The parliament that will be seated will not have no legitimacy. And you know when the parliament does not have a legitimacy, and then already the president's legitimacy is contested, then we are looking for trouble and civil unrest.
Omar Haruna is the former Benin ambassador to the United States. He spoke with VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondin from Washington. Meanwhile, Sosou Jessimanen is a businessman and resident in the capital, Cotonou. He says he was among those supporting President Patrice Talon when he first got elected, but is currently disillusioned about the recent development and called for the restoration of peace and vibrant democracy.
Some are not believing that it is possible in Benin. Some are reacting by burning the material that will serve for the election. In the east, in the northern part, we have seen that today. But I say that the international community has failed Benin because this crisis that the country is about to enter can be stopped.
You said the international community has failed Benin. According to you, what they should have done before?
When Benin was voting that law, where they want people to be candidates at the presidency to pay almost $500,000 to be candidates as president in this country, almost the same amount for the list that is going for the legislative, the parliament election. This money is prohibitive because many people cannot get that money and go and say, okay, here is a $500,000, and now I'm ready to go to election. This was a mistake that the whole international community closed their mouth, closed their eyes, did like nothing happened, and they let it go.
What is the mindset of the people in Benin today for those elections?
Many in Benin, the psychology is that people don't tell you what they're about to do because they don't know who you are. Are you going to go against them? They don't know. You will see them acting. That's it. Many people are not going to go to vote. If you get close to them, they know you, they'll tell you. They are not going to go and vote. Some say they promise them money to go and vote, all this. But the issue is that the majority will not vote. That one is guaranteed. I have seen legislative election in Benin many times. But this one, I had never seen it before.
What do you think people and the different parties should do now for a peaceful election?
What I have observing, the government also is preparing to fight back. Even the Minister of Interior say, if you burn, they will burn. We will burn you. If you destroy, you, we will destroy you. If you break, we will break you. You know, these kind of words are not made to stabilize, to bring peace. The issue here is that we need to preserve peace. And to preserve peace, for me, right now, the best solution is to try to stop the process now and find common ground and let it continue.
Sosou Jessimanen is a businessman in Benin. He spoke with VOA's French to Africa reporter Raissa Girondin from the Beninois capital, Cotonou. The leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLMIO, will lead a delegation of the group to a meeting organized by the regional bloc IGAD in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa this week. According to the SPLMIO, the party received an official invitation letter calling for a meeting to take stock of the revitalized peace agreement. IGAD officials say the meeting will focus on the implementation of the peace agreement as well as the next steps forward. For more about the IGAD meeting, I reached Manasseh Zindo, the SPLMIO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports.
We received an invitation from IGAD that heads of all the parties who are signatory should they revitalize the agreement, should attend an important meeting in Addis Ababa, I understand, to take stock of what has happened so far, what has not happened, and probably the way forward. So on behalf of the SPLM-IO, Dr. Riek Machar will be leading the team.
What will be the expectations of the SPLM-IO regarding this call or this invitation by IGAD? Because this is not the first time stock has been taken after peace agreement have been signed. The implementation thereof becomes wobbly. They take stock. What is going to be different this time, if I may ask you?
This is really the first time since the revitalizer agreement was signed on the 12th of September 2018. So we've been expecting the IGAD to take over now since President Omar al-Bashir, who was in forefront of leading the talks that resulted in the signing of the revitalizer agreement. So now that IGAD is taking over, what we expect from the meeting is that the government and us will agree to speed up the remaining provisions which has not been completed during the pre-transitional period.
But Manasseh, a lot of South Sudanese blame the two major proponents, the government in Juba and the SPLM-IO, for the lack of commitment to the implementation of this revitalized agreement. And they blame you for not wanting to ensure that your end of the bargain is implemented to ensure the conflict ends for people to go back to their regular lives.
I tell you that the civil population do not blame the SPLM-IO. It is just that they do not have the space to express themselves. If there was free space in South Sudan, people would have turned up in big numbers, you know, to blame the government for all these delaying tactics in the full implementation of the agreement. The people are with the IO, and the IO will not let down the people. If the SPLM-IO let down the people and succumb to these gimmicks by the government, the suffering of the people of South Sudan will go on for a very, very long time.
Supporters of the government are saying that President Salva Kiir has demonstrated his commitment by his latest call on Dr. Riek Machar to come to Juba so that the two could work together to bring peace, to end the conflict and the ongoing crisis. So South Sudanese can have the reprieve, those who have been forced to flee their homes, to become refugees in neighboring countries, to return home to their normal lives, so life can begin anew for them. And that it is the fault of the SPLM-IO to continue this trend of violence, of conflict, of attacking government positions, among other issues, in spite of the signed revitalized agreement.
I don't know which call are the supporters of the government talking about. If it is about the letter that you and I read, one would even wonder why in the letter the president is telling Dr. Riek Machar that he should not focus on ticking all the boxes. Why should we not tick all the boxes? This is something that we agreed to, that it is possible, and all the boxes that were supposed to be ticked during the pre-transitional period must be ticked. This way, the people will have confidence. The people will believe that peace has come. The people who are in the internally displaced camps will feel safe to come out. Those who are in the neighboring countries in the refugee camps will also feel comfortable to return back to the country. So all the boxes which were supposed to be ticked during the pre-transitional period must be ticked.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth, Empowerment and Sports. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, Sudanese opposition parties say they have agreed with the military council to form a joint group to run the affairs of the country in a transitional phase until elections are held. The announcement came following a meeting between the opposition groups and the military council. Local media reports say the groups have so far agreed on the composition of the government. Meanwhile, the African Union is scheduled to meet to discuss the situation in Sudan this week. For more about the Sudanese transitional agreement, I reached Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari, a leading member of the Sudanese opposition Umma Party.
The signatories of Declaration of Freedom and Change
they reach an agreement to form a government, a coalition government with a military council. This will be 8 members are civilians and seven members are from the army. And this will continue for 6 months. The rotation will be like in presidential rotation. The current head of the army council will be the head of presidential council. And after 6 months, will be rotation, presidential rotation, based on selection of the member of the council itself.
The announcement failed to define the task of the transitional team.
Yesterday, there is a meeting, and on that meeting, it has been decided the number of presidential council and how many people from the army. Also, it has been decided, and how many people from the civilians or how many members of the civilian. Also, it has been decided. So now, just we come to the stage of implementing that agreement and put it in the right format and context. So and also the mission and the statements or the framework that the council should follow also already it has been agreed based on the Declaration of Freedom and Change. What is the role? What is the objectives? What steps that it should be followed? What is the means of governance? And how to? And what is the sort of accountabilities? Like everything, it has been decided or it has been agreed for that council, because we don't need to leave it just is open for the presidential council to put or to implement what they think is right.
So what happens next in this transitional phase until elections are held? Because a lot of people are demanding a total break from the military, because they said they've had military rule for all these years, so they don't want to even have any members of the military's hand in the governance of the country, even if it's in the transitional period. So what happens next?
So I believe the participation of the army is very important, because we come out of 30 years of rule of a tough government that it empowers their people to dominate all sectors of the country, and they have been anywhere on all services and sectors and departments of the government. For this, we need like a genuine people from military to cooperate with the civilians to manage to take the government away from all the bad practices and corruptions and all failures that Sudan come across in the last 30 years. For this, I believe the next stage of the military council is very clear, because they will be ruling for 2 years and will be reviewed again if we need to extend the transition period. I believe if we let this council to lead for 4 years, we will create a very good atmosphere for the next stage after the transition government, because we will come to a new era in Sudan, which we will have to go for free and fair elections, and that free and fair elections demanded to create a better rules of voter registrations. And
one concern some Sudanese are expressing is the fact that your leader, Al-Mahdi, says that former President al-Bashir should be sent to the International Criminal Court to face charges there.
We speak about our Sudanese, they should make the right maneuver to join the International Criminal Court, because we face a lot of problems because we have not been members of that court. And when last year, or maybe in the last, since Bashir's been indictments of committing genocides and crimes against humanity, we didn't manage to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, because Sudan are not member of that court. But now we have to apply to gain full membership of International Criminal Courts and understand the mechanism and how it works. And also Sudanese solicitors, barristers, and all people working in the legal sectors, they should be very proactive in making that statement real. Or put it in the reality.
Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari is a leading member of the Sudanese opposition Umma Party. He spoke with me from London. This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Kenyan innovators are betting on digital technologies to attract young people to an agricultural industry that currently is dominated by an aging population, with a 98% mobile phone penetration, according to the latest data from the Communications Authority of Kenya. The cell phone is proving to be an important source of extension services in areas where such resources are not available. For VOA, Sarah Kimani has more.
As a young girl in central Kenya, Penina Wanja witnessed firsthand the challenge of raising cattle without professional help.
Growing up in a farm where my mom had two cows, poorly managed, they could give us two cups of milk.
As a practicing extension officer, Wanja noticed gaps in information made farmers rely on trial and error in their day-to-day activities. The results yielded low productivity.
It's a gap that I saw. Because when you look at even the statistics and the nature that is on the ground, our government has provided at least one extension officer to close to 4,000 farmers. So there is actually a need for these critical services.
She came up with DigiCow, a mobile phone application that offers experts advice to farmers and allows them to keep up-to-date records on their cows. Stanley Kamau was among the early users of the app. Now, a year since its launch, and almost a year since she started using it, he talks of increased milk yields, healthier herds, and a well-organized farm.
They got a platform on the app where we say, for example, during the time for mating, you keep your records, then you get to know when your cow may calf down. But you know, in the old way, you used to take dates. You do the cumbersome work of counting down. But with the Digi app, it's helpful because it sends you a reminder on when you expect your cow to calf down.
80% of Kenya's population is made up of small-scale farmers, according to the World Bank. DigiCow is an example of how technology can be used to bridge the knowledge gaps in the farming sector, while at the same time ensuring food security. It is also a way of encouraging Kenya's unemployed youth to take up farming, according to Boniface Akuku, an information and communications expert based in Nairobi.
Research says that the average age of a Kenyan farmer is 60, which is almost a retired person. That person has no energy. So what we need is what I would call mind change philosophy. We need to change the mind of our people to encourage young people to engage into farming. Otherwise, if that does not change, the uptake of this technology will be zero.
With mobile phone subscribers in Kenya, mobile-based solutions make sense as information can reach millions of people while at the same time changing the way Kenyans farm, says Boniface.
African agriculture must be disrupted, and we have no way about it. Even if we don't disrupt it by technology, already climate is disrupting it.
To deal with the issues of illiteracy, DigiCow has a voice-based service which Wanja says has proven helpful to the older farmer. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Kenya.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Guinea will face Cameroon in the final of the Under-17 Africa Cup of Nations in Tanzania after both won their semi-finals on penalties. Guinea were 10-9 winners over Nigeria in a tense shootout after Nigeria's David Oduko Ogaga missed his spot kick at the National Stadium in Dar es Salaam. The two teams had played out a goalless draw after 90 minutes before the match went straight to penalties. Guinea's players celebrated the country's first qualification for the Under-17 Nations Cup final. The Sili cadets are now assured of $5,000 each which had been promised by their government if they had reached the final. Guinea finished third at the 1995, 2015 and 2017 editions of the Under-17 finals. In the day's second semi-final, Cameroon held on with 10 men to beat Angola 4-3 on penalties after the semi-final had also ended goalless. Cameroon captain Fabrice Nzeye Mezama was sent off after 47 minutes for two yellow cards, but his side survived the second half to get past the Angolans on spot kicks. All four semi-finalists have qualified to represent Africa at the Under-2017 FIFA World Cup to take place in Brazil in November. Meanwhile, Wydad Casablanca beat Mamelodi Sundowns 2-1 in their CAF Champions League semi-final first leg clash in Rabat on Friday evening. Goals from Sheldaine Saidi and Auk Badi secured a narrow aggregate lead for the Moroccans ahead of the reverse fixture in South Africa on May 4th. Anele scored the vital away goal for the South Africans, who know a 1-0 win in the second leg will be enough to send them through to the final. In the other semi-final, TP Mazembe of DR Congo lost 1-0 to Esperance of Tunisia in Tunis on Saturday. Mohamed Youssef Belaili scored in the 51st minute to put the hosts ahead. TP Mazembe's Babaso Chongo was sent off in the 74th minute for a second yellow card. Morocco have made their return to the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers after a successful appeal over the eligibility of Democratic Republic of Congo defender Assene Zola. The North Africans had lost 2-1 on aggregate against DR Congo last month, but have been reinstated after CAF ruled that TP Mazembe Zola was above the age limit. Morocco will now face Mali in June's final round of qualifiers for this year's Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations finals in Egypt. The top three from November's finals will qualify for the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. Olympic qualifiers are restricted to Under-23 footballers, with three overage stars permitted at the finals. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's Robin Kerio and Ethiopia's Sasho Insemu set race records at the 42nd Rock and Roll Madrid Marathon, crossing the line of the IAAF Gold Labor Road Race in 2:08:18 and 2:26:24, respectively, on Saturday. While the 25-year-old Kerio led a Kenyan clean sweep of medals, Insemu obliterated the previous record by over 4 minutes, getting the better from her fellow Ethiopian Fatele Dejana Segai. Kerio crossed the finish line in 2 hours, 8 minutes and 18 seconds, taking nearly a full minute off the previous race record. Kipsang and Kirui also dipped inside the previous mark set in 2014. This was Kerio's first win at an IAAF Gold Labor Road event. And in the women's race, paced by compatriot Fikadu Kabede, Ethiopia's Sasho Insemu won in style in 2:26:24 with a 41-second advantage over Testify Dejeni, while Bekele completed an Ethiopian sweep in 2 hours, 32 minutes and 15 seconds. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sport. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Abizi featuring Davido with Sugar. And then Sheba comes your way with Try My Love. Then Two Face with African Queen. And then Shaggy and Timba featuring Emmy with Go Down. I want your body just to dance a lot.
boy, you lose so. Oh boy, your body they make me the dance. See now you they make my head they go korongo.
Korongo.
And I just they love your body so. Alango.
Alango.
And my heart and soul is up for you, my baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Me no one night stand. Blow my mind, I'ma give you that song. I have no
no problem, baby. But I love you so much, baby. Girl, be my gradual lifestyle this, but I do it for my baby. Fire hot, hot, you are hotter than that. Papa put it up, come feel my pretty bum. Sometimes I just wanna rock you non-stop, like I'm always stuff from the city London. Try me, I know you wanna fail me. My boy, try me.
Yeah, yeah, you are my African queen. Ooh, Lord, ooh, Lord. Just like the sun lights up the earth, you light up my life. The only one I ever see with a smile so bright. Just yesterday, you came around my way. You changed my whole scene way with your astonishing beauty. Oh, you couldn't make a brother sing. No ordinary thing, a supernatural being. And no, you are brighter than the moon, brighter than the star. I love you just the way you are. And you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been, yeah. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty, yeah. You stand as one, the outstanding one. I look into your eyes, girl, what I see is paradise. Hey, you captivated my soul. Now every day I want you more. I cannot deny this feeling I'm feeling inside. No one cannot take your place, you cannot take your space. It's a fact I cannot erase. And no, you are the one that makes me smile, make me float like a boat upon the Nile. Girl, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been. You make my heart go ding-a-ling-a-ling. Yeah, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. You are my African queen, and I know, oh yes I know. You are my African queen, and I know. See, I know what I am feeling in my heart and in my soul. Oh, I know that it's this love, and I know that this love was surely sent from up above. Cause you're the only one that I think of. You are my African queen, and I know that this means that you're the only one that I will serve. I'll give you my heart, my love, my body and my money. Every other thing you think of. In a man, who could think of anything better than you? Who could think of ever hurting you? Sacrifice my all, I'll give it all to you. You are my African queen, for real. You are my African queen, the girl of my dream, the girl of my dream. You may have never been. Oh, na na, yeah. Oh, la, la. You are my African queen. You are my African queen, the girl of my dream. My African.
love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Munyemo, I love you, I love you, I love you. Munyemo, I love you, I love you. Oh yeah, my African queen, I love you, I love you.
Once upon a rhyme,
nakumbuka Mary alikusumbua.
Once upon a time, once upon a rhyme,
ulitaji sana bado kachengua.
Umekumbwa na jini gani? Mbona mami hatuelewani? Hata jini kisirani sio kama we,
wala jini makata kufikiwe.
Kosa langu kukuweka ndani, haijulikani ndani mwanaume nani. Kila siku vituko tu,
mara moja moja baby unajiweka down.
Kwanza sema na moyo wako, usiringie uzuri wako. Kuna kupandaga mami na kushuka,
tupendane forever mpaka kufa.
Usiku nikipita Twitter, mami na kukuta Twitter. Nikisema nikucheki Insta, nakuta usha posti picha.
Pesa zisikupe uchizi, kiburi na kutudharau. Wale tulokupa shavu, sasa unatusahau.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Juna.
Good evening, Africa. The conduct of international relations is at a perilous crossroad. In this regard, future historians may well observe that while the international rule-based system is being shattered, the non-aligned movement, NAM, fell asleep. NAM was created as a result of the emergence of two major hostile alliance systems in Europe: the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, led by the United States, and the Warsaw Treaty Organization, led by then Soviet Union. These two military opposing systems tried to recruit other members of the international system within their camps. And many of the former colonial states who became independent decided that they would not join military alliances, and initially they called themselves neutral states. Then they became non-aligned states or non-aligned movements. The organization has very, very powerful leaders, independent, unafraid, such as Tito of Yugoslavia, Sukarno of Indonesia, Nkrumah of Ghana, Nasser of Egypt, and Nehru of India. They became very powerful voices in the international system, and they were able to pronounce rules which the two aligned systems could not ignore. By their sheer numbers, they were a powerful voice within the General Assembly of the United Nations, and they did not hesitate to use their influence to prevent war. For them, the United Nations Charter was vitally important, and they guarded it and promoted it. But when the Cold War ended, first the Warsaw Pact disbanded, NATO did not disband, but many sought to see what NAM will do. This came at a foreign minister's conference of NAM in Accra, Ghana, in September 1991. Two members of NAM, perhaps egged on by non-PAM members, promoted the idea that with the end of the Cold War, NAM should be disbanded. This was vigorously debated in Accra. And at the end, the members said, no, NAM has its usefulness for its members, and they said they will not disband, but hinted that should NATO disband, they might also consider disbanding. But now, over the years, NAM has retreated into the shadow. And at a time when certain developments are taking place in the international system that may be perilous for them, we see the rise of popularism. We see the rise of unilateralism at a time when multilateralism is at stress. We see the return of the tendency to promote regime change, even though we have ample evidence that these policies are futile, as we saw in Iraq and in Libya. But one that is going to be of greater impact to non-members is unilateralism. We now see powerful states with the drop of a hat are unilaterally imposing sanctions and then demand that the rest of the international community observe their sanctions. If they refuse, then they also are subjected to further sanctions. Ignoring the Security Council. The Security Council has been a place now where the five permanent members operate without any control. Yet, the Security Council now meets in regular sessions, mainly to adopt resolution that will control the lives and interests of small and weak states. So this is not the time for NAM to be asleep. The dangers are around us. International institutions that have been laboriously negotiated have been abandoned at random. Circles and decisions of the Security Council, such as settlements and occupation, have been thrown aside. This is why NAM needs to re-engage. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, an ugly child of your own is more to you than a beautiful one belonging to your neighbor. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News.